The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Washington Post and National Geographic Traveler. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Hurricane Florence is gone, but she left her mark on much of southeastern and south-central North Carolina. Storms, earthquakes, volcanoes, and tsunamis are among the many ways nature can affect us, not only close to home, but also those places where we might like to visit, such as the beaches and lakes, just as one example. It will be months before some areas return to normalcy and people can again be able to enjoy that special spot maybe where they can just get away from the daily grind. While we monitored Florence and the devastation she unleashed, we came across an interesting travel article that focused on traveling to get away from it all. In her article, Leaving Technology Behind on Vacation in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, writer Kate Morgan tells us about a growing trend among younger travelers to disconnect from the high tech and experience life in places that have managed to protect their unique way of life. Now, her article is found in the June 22, 2018 issue of the Washington Post. Children are welcome at Ironstone Acres, the bed and breakfast that Sharon Zimmerman has been running for nearly 30 years in rural Narbonne, Pennsylvania. But they'll need to entertain themselves. The Mennonite-owned dairy farm has no internet connection and no TVs, and you'll have to head into town to find a newspaper. The severed connection to technology in favor of the farm's peace and quiet is exactly what draws many of Zimmerman's visitors. The first day, the kids will beg for the phones or the iPad, Zimmerman said, but pretty quickly, they start wanting to be out in the pasture or feeding the calves or playing in the creek. Unplugged travel is a fast-growing trend, with startups and luxury resorts alike marketing digital detox packages. Hotels such as North Carolina's Sanderling Resort and the Four Seasons Costa Rica offer gifts and discounts to those willing to relinquish their phones at the front desk. In February, group travel company Off the Grid announced tech-free trips to Portugal, Croatia, Peru, and other destinations. Travelers are issued social media-free flip phones and disposable cameras to use for the duration of their trip. The offering sold out almost immediately. The 2018 Alamo Rent-A-Car Family Vacation Survey found that 43% of respondents would prefer to be unable to use social media while on vacation. Nearly a quarter of those surveyed said they had seen technology ruin a family vacation. When travelers do disconnect, their reward may be a more authentic experience, something market research suggests is particularly important to millennials. Of Americans surveyed for the Expedia Millennial Traveler Report, 62% said the most important part of a vacation is experiencing the authentic culture of a place. An authentic cultural experience is one of the biggest drivers of tourism in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, which had an influx of nearly $2 billion from visitors in 2017. The region is home to the country's second-largest Amish population, a community known for rejection of modern conveniences such as cars and electricity, as well as a modest style of dress. Tourists interested in the plain people visit stores and farmers' markets full of Amish-made furniture and quilts and pay a premium to ride in horse-drawn buggies. Dave Hansen, who lives in a nearby suburb of Philadelphia, felt that the average visitor experience was still less than authentic. So many people came to Lancaster because they're interested in the Amish, he said, but they end up running into the kitschy stuff and people go away disappointed. Well, about 3 years ago, Hansen was working as a developer, building websites for traditional bed and breakfast operations around the country. I approached an Amish dairy farmer one day who didn't have a website, but who I knew ran a guest house on his farm, Hansen said. He created a website that offered bookings at the farmer's guest house. Most Amish families don't have computers, and very few use email, so Hansen fielded the responses. I ended up getting so many emails that I started looking around for other Amish farms that would welcome visitors, he said. Today, Hansen has 6 Amish guest houses listed on his site, AmishFarmStay.com. And that site, again, is AmishFarmStay.com. Amish is spelled A-M-I-S-H. None of the homes has electricity. One doesn't have a single outlet, so forget even charging your phone. But most use solar energy to power lights and propane or natural gas to run refrigerators. Hansen provides a personalized booking service connecting people looking for an authentic rural experience with lodging options that offer total immersion into this lifestyle. Over Memorial Day weekend, Kate and Alex Flaxman of Swedesboro, New Jersey, stayed at Pleasant View Farm Guest House, operated by Lena Stoltzfus and her husband Dave. Both Alex and myself have friends and family who are ultra-Orthodox Jews, Kate Flaxman said. They use no electricity on Saturdays, so that part wasn't so bizarre for us. We were just like, oh, they do this all the time. The whole weekend was just really peaceful. We slept in the with the windows open and listened to the horses neighing outside. During the day, Flaxman said she was able to relax with her husband and their daughter, 7-month-old Piper, without feeling pressure to answer work emails or the temptation to switch on the TV. The Flaxmans also took advantage of an add-on that Hansen organizes for guests at all the properties he partners with. We got to have dinner at another Amish home, Flaxman said. It was us and 3 other groups who were staying at guest houses. We got to eat the amazing food this woman prepared and chat with her and her family. We asked them about church, dairy farming, school, areas where there are obviously a lot of differences in the way we do things. Lena Stoltz says she loves providing her guests with a peaceful getaway, and she says she hopes they leave with a better understanding of her way of life. I like to sit and chat with everybody who comes, get to know them, and let them get to know me, she said. I hope they see we have more in common than they might expect. The Amish choose to do things a certain way, but we share the same joy in sitting on a quiet porch and having a nice long talk. The Stolfuses have been welcoming guests since March, and there have been few days when the guest house hasn't been booked. Hansen said the demand was so great for the Amish farms that he began to look to nearby Mennonite community. Although their religious practices and conservative style of dress are similar to that of the Amish, modern Mennonite families usually drive cars and have electricity and phones, but no TV or internet in their homes. Hansen built a second website, LancasterFarmBNB.com. Again, that is LancasterFarmBNB.com. That's the letter B, letter N, B. This site lists 11 primarily Mennonite-owned bed and breakfasts, among them Zimmerman's Ironstone Acres. Since Dave put us on the web, he's pretty much tripled our guests, Zimmerman said. In the large log home that Zimmerman and her husband share, a guest suite decorated with a forest motif accommodates a family of 7. The aptly named garden room with its purple and green color scheme can comfortably fit a couple with a small child. A few steps away in the 18th-century farmhouse occupied by Zimmerman's son and daughter-in-law, a Victorian-themed bedroom and a large loft can sleep up to 10 guests. All of the beds boast Amish-made quilts chosen by Zimmerman. While the sleeping arrangements are spacious and comfortable, it's the amenities and the authenticity that bring many visitors back again and again, she said. We have people who come back every year, and a lot of them are young families with children. At first, parents can be a little sensitive, she said. They come from places where it's not normal to tell your kid to go play and then not see them until dinner time. But it's amazing how quickly a person can relax and be comfortable letting their kids roam. We've got 80 acres, so there's plenty to explore. We'll bring our grandkids over, too, so they can show our guests children around and keep them out of trouble. This is a working dairy farm with more than 100 cows, Zimmerman continued. When we have teenagers here, they can come out and help us hay the fields. They get sweaty and dirty, and then they can go down to the pond and have a nice swim. The pond isn't your average watering hole. The Zimmermans dredge the spring-fed pool annually, and sliding boards at both ends provide a fun entry into the crystal-clear water. There's not many places you can visit your own private beach in the middle of a cow, Pastor Zimmerman said, laughing. Guests at the Bread and Breakfast have first dibs on the pond and its grills and picnic table, but local families may also stop by for a swim. A list of rules posted nearby reminds visitors that the Zimmermans and their neighbors appreciate a modest choice of clothing. Bikinis are not allowed, and they prefer that gentlemen swim with a shirt on. Lancaster County offers plenty to do off the farm. Dutch Wonderland, a 48-acre amusement park geared toward younger children, features more than 30 rides and a water play area. Farmers markets and shopping outlets abound, and dining options range from upscale gourmet to down-home barbecue. But after a busy day, there are a few things more welcome than the quiet of the farm. The area has a lot you can do, Flaxman said, and you can definitely stay busy, but it's also the perfect place to get a change of pace. Somehow, being away from all our technology was even more peaceful than I anticipated. By the way, Kate Morgan is based in Pennsylvania, and if you'd like to visit the Amish community or the Mennonites of Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, here are some travel tips that were a part of the article and that you might want to keep in mind. We'll start with where to stay. Ironstone Acres, 344 South Pool Forge Road in Narbonne, Pennsylvania, and that's N-A-R-B-O-N. And they have a website, Ironstone Acres website, ironstoneacres.com. Again, that's ironstoneacres.com. Bed and breakfast lodging in a log home, this 18th century farmhouse and dairy farm, can accommodate families and large groups. Rooms with a shared bath from $85. Pleasant View Farm Guest House, and it's at 3301 Harvest Drive in Gordonville, Pennsylvania, and they have a rather lengthy website to check them out, Pleasant View Farm Guest House. It's amishfarmstay.com/room/pleasant-view-farm-guesthouse. amishfarmstay.com/room/pleasant-view-farm-guesthouse. Spacious in-home lodging on a quiet farm includes a full private kitchen and can accommodate up to four adults. Rooms from $90 for two adults. Now, how about where to eat? Well, Shady Maple Smorgasbord, you'll find that at 129 Toddy Drive, East Earl, Pennsylvania. And they also have an online listing, so you can get more information about Shady Maple Smorgasbord at shady-maple.com, shady-maple.com. All-you-can-eat buffet open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, featuring traditional Pennsylvania Dutch cooking. Dinner buffet starts at $19.99. Then there's the Cork and Cap at 480 New Holland Avenue, Suite 3000, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And you can check them out at corkandcaprestaurant.com. That's corkandcaprestaurant.com. This is traditional Pennsylvania Dutch comfort food with a modern twist and a focus on farm-to-table ingredients. And entrees start at $18. And then there's Maison at 230 North Prince Street, Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And the way they spell it is M-A, parenthesis I, little I, parenthesis S-O-N, Maison. And that's the way it is on the website, MaisonLancaster.com, M-A-I-S-O-N, MaisonLancaster.com. This is a family-owned, bring-your-own-booze, I guess. It says B-Y-O-B. I'm sure they meant beverage. Anyway, bring-your-own-beverage, slow-food restaurant with seasonal, locally-procured dishes that change weekly. Entrees start at $28. Now, about what to do? Well, there's Dutch Wonderland at 2249 Lincoln Highway in East Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Online, you can find more information at DutchWonderland.com. This is a 40-acre-plus amusement park, great for toddlers or to early adolescents. Open 10 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., Memorial Day to Labor Day. Tickets cost $39.99 for ages 3 to 59, and the younger kids are free. Discounted tickets also are available for seniors. And then we have the Strasburg Railroad at 301 Gap Road in Rocks, Pennsylvania. And you can find out more about them at StrasburgRailroad.com, S-T-R-A-S-B-U-R-G, StrasburgRailroad.com. What is billed as America's oldest operating railroad offers 45-minute rides on authentic steam locomotives. First train leaves at 11 a.m. Tickets start at $15.50. Then there's the Green Dragon Farmers Market and auction at Ephrata, Pennsylvania. They spell that E-P-H-R-A-T-A, Ephrata, Pennsylvania. And you can find out more at the Green Dragon Market.com website, greendragonmarket.com. One of the area's largest farmers markets, Green Dragon, has fresh food, produce, crafts, and more. It's open Fridays from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., and there's free admission. And finally, there's the Fulton Theater at 12 North Prince Street in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And you can check them out at thefulton.org, thefulton.org, F-U-L-T-O-N. A historical theater with Broadway-style musicals, children's shows, and experimental theater, and prices vary by show. And if you'd like more information about that area, there's also discoverlancaster.com, that's discoverlancaster.com, and amishfarmstay.com, amishfarmstay.com, and lancasterfarmbnb.com, that's lancasterfarmbnb.com. So lots of things to do in that part of the world. Quite interesting, huh? Well, that's time to move on, I'm afraid, even though we've enjoyed our stay here. And from the trying-to-be tech-free culture of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, we're going to head to South America. We're off the coast of Ecuador. Writer Noah Stryker explores bird life in an essay, The Thing with Feathers. This is in the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Face down in the water, fins on my feet, and breathing through a plastic tube, I've assumed the position of a Galapagos tourist, snorkeling where many have snorkeled before at the Devil's Crown Crater off Floriana Island. Parrotfish, angelfish, and colorful wrasses school in my shadow, while a garden eel blends into the coral below. As I kick into the current, a flash suddenly cuts through my periphery, approaching fast underwater. It's about 2 feet long, shaped like a chubby torpedo, guided by short flippers and covered with scaly-looking feathers, improbable yet unmistakable in these equatorial waters, a Galapagos penguin. For the past 2 months, I'd been living with a genial host family, taking classes in a study abroad program, and steadily checking off many of the island's famous birds, bizarre blue-footed boobies, smudgy lava herons, and soaring great frigate birds, but the tropical Galapagos penguin had remained elusive. This one seems curious and unafraid. It swims up to my snorkel mask as if to say hello, pausing a few inches away before darting into the depths. It is the first wild penguin I've ever seen, and this meeting makes me yearn for more. In the years to come, I would follow penguins elsewhere as a researcher and guide on more than 20 trips to Antarctica and many of the world's sub-Antarctic islands. But for the moment, I am ecstatic. People weren't always so impressed with Galapagos bird life. For thousands of years, the archipelago hid its secrets from the rest of the world. Even a 26-year-old Charles Darwin, during his near-mythical sojourn to the islands, had mixed feelings at first. Nothing could be less inviting, he said, of Chatham, now San Cristobal Island. By then, Darwin had been at sea for almost 4 years and had absorbed so much of the wild world that it would take him a lifetime to process it all. After returning home, he'd never leave England again. He collected a few bird specimens, many of which he forgot to label by island, and spent a lot of time looking for rocks. Yet Darwin's name has become inextricably linked with Galapagos birds because they offer classic examples of adaptive radiation, the process by which species evolve to occupy new niches. Darwin noted that each island hosted a different type of mockingbird, and he was surprised when his friend John Gould later suggested that the varieties of finches were closely related. Galapagos birds helped Darwin craft a theory of evolution that changed humanity's view of life on Earth, and the eponymous Darwin's finches, the group of about 15 species that evolved different beak sizes and shapes to eat different foods, are living reminders of Darwin's historic contributions. Today, the Galapagos present an Eden for birds. Before the advent of sailing ships, the only way to reach the islands was to fly, swim, or float, which ensured that no land mammal bigger than a rice rat could get there. The result is a lost horizon-like avian utopia, an isolated paradise free of predators and refreshed by cold ocean currents. What a bottomless buffet of all-you-can-eat seafood. Evolutionary relationships have slowly revealed their mysteries in this relatively pristine natural laboratory. For instance, the flightless cormorant, descended from a flying ancestor, succumbed to the same forces that stripped penguins of flight. Without predators, it was energetically more rewarding to swim rather than to fly. The great frigate bird went another way. Because its feathers aren't waterproof, it cannot land on the ocean, and it has developed efficient wings to patrol the surrounding areas. Recent studies show that frigate birds can stay aloft for weeks at a time, catching sleep in 12-second power naps. As biologists continue to probe the evolutionary pressure cooker, Galapagos birds spark fresh insights. The scientists Peter and Rosemary Grant, who spent 40 years working on obscure Daphne Major Island announced in late 2017 they had documented a new self-sustaining and reproductively isolated population of Darwin's finch that appeared within two generations after an outsider arrived and mated with local birds. In other words, a new species evolved before their very eyes. But most modern visitors to the Galapagos spend little time watching the finches, which are, after all, rather drab. Their closest living relative in South America is the dull-colored grassquit. Instead, more than 200,000 tourists flock each year to the islands to experience the thrill of having to be careful not to step on the wildlife. They watch gigantic waved albatrosses perform courtship dances within arm's length, buy I Love Boobies t-shirts, and fill up memory cards with point-blank images of feathered friends. Birds are at the center of the Galapagos' booming ecotourism business, which has supplanted fishing as the region's most lucrative commercial activity. Like rare coins and luxury cars, the value of wilderness increases as its supply shrinks. We now need places like the Galapagos, a symbol of both immaculate, mature, and rapid evolutionary change, to remind us of what once was and to help us envision what could be. Even if we argue that the natural environment has no intrinsic value, it's hard to deny the inexorable draw of nature. When you watch a waved albatross tenderly regurgitate seafood to its chick on Espanola Island, where virtually the entire population nest, you can't help but feel some kinship with early explorers who witnessed the same scene. When a red-billed tropic bird swoops along a knife-edged precipice, riding the updrafts, you wonder if its mate waits patiently nearby. Birds are universal. They engage our imaginations, and they help us connect to the world around us. Just as birds stirred Darwin to develop his groundbreaking theories, they have the power to fascinate any curious observer, not just the Galapagos, but everywhere on Earth. Although many avian species around the world are in trouble, threatened by reflective windows, feral cats, single-use plastics, climate change, habitat loss, and other human-induced effects, people are increasingly moved to action. As the conservationist Thomas Lovejoy observed, if you take care of birds, you take care of most of the environmental problems of the world. Wow. Writer Noah Stricker, by the way, is associate editor of Birding Magazine and the author of four bird books. He's going to serve as the onboard naturalist, of the Nat Geo Expedition's Winds Over Costa Rica, and these trips will be taking place in January 2019. Well, another essay in the August-September 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler is titled Revelations Along a London Road. Writer Ellen Himmelfarb discovers that in the British capital, a street can have many names, especially if it's been around for about 2,000 years. Shall we go down the street and see what we can learn? Most mornings, you can find me buying bananas from the Bengali grocery on the main street behind my northeast London house. I'll get my almond milk latte from the Italian barista with the twisty mustache in a cafe where striped back walls reveal tile work from the butcher shop that operated on this site 100 years ago. I may pick up a paper from the Egyptian news agent who has a sign in the window proudly proclaiming his establishment is porn-free. The street on highway signs as the A10 runs north from London Bridge toward Cambridge. The street is known on highway signs as A10 as it runs north from London Bridge. There we go, toward Cambridge. But my stretch of it is unusually neighborly for the British capital. I recognize the geezers smoking outside the pub and the literati amassing at the indie bookshop from champagne launches, and they know me as the American, though I'm Canadian and have lived in this neighborhood for a decade. It's hard to imagine from the dingy kebab shops and the line of people cashing their welfare checks at the post office that this road once belonged to the Romans. Roads are a lot like people. You can never presume to know all the stories simmering beneath the surface. British historians tend not to shout about Romans marching up through the center of town, but pounding this pavement with the curiosity of a foreigner has helped me to picture it not as a channel carrying people north and south, but as a lure drawing them from west and east. Yes, a road can be a destination, the point of travel itself. Many are, even those you can see from your bedroom window. This road story begins almost 2,000 years ago. when the Romans marked their arrival in Londinium with a wooden bridge over a narrow stretch of the Thames. Up the north bank, they built a colonnade, and before it, a lively wharf where they'd unload olive oil, wine, and fish sauce from the old country, anything to make the local food palatable. The resulting road, referred to as Ermine Street in centuries past, terraced up a gentle hill and leveled off at a great forum, likely about half the size of Rome's. The road then breached the defensive stone ramparts that surrounded Londinium before making a straight shot all the way to York. If I look up from my commute at just the right time, I'll often spot a bit of wall wedged between office towers, a relic that survived the fall of the Roman Empire and the 1,000 years of economic changes and recovery that followed. By the Middle Ages, Londoners were starting from scratch. Even sturdier bridges followed, ultimately shifting 100 feet west of the original. The new thoroughfare headed uptown. The blocks they left behind became quaint-sounding Fish Street Hill. If there's anything that keeps London visitors on their toes, it's the tendency of these ancient roads to change names every few blocks. North of Fish Street Hill, just as I got used to the road becoming Gracechurch Street, it abruptly morphs into Bishop's Gate, named for an entry into the old walled city. Then, for two blocks, Norton Folgate takes over. According to word on the street, this area is where playwright Christopher Marlowe once pummeled a foe or two into the cobbles. My romance with the road really bloomed on the scrappy section carrying on from here. When I started coming to Shoreditch High Street nearly 20 years ago, as a young, newly married colonial from Toronto, the sooty facades offered few reminders of the blue-collar community that once thrived here. The words commercial ironworks, emblazoned on a mosaic frieze, a pamphlet-esque advertising pianos on brick wall. We arrived by tube and squint through the night for a bacchanal in a former stable or warehouse. Friends opened a bar in a former handbag exporter shop exhibiting graffiti by artists living out of their cars. We'd stop in after Bun Zhao in Little Hanoi, the only neighbors with the lights on. I had a vague understanding that Hadrian had been here first, but I was preoccupied with the road that was reinventing itself there and then. When an American apparel shop popped up, we jeered. This was no place for manufactured hipster grit. I couldn't have predicted an Ace Hotel would follow within the decade, along with luxury mixed high-rise called The Stage, so named because Shakespeare's Curtain Theater stood just a few yards away. Parenthood forced us to seek our narrow Victorian row house near north of Regent's Channel, or canal, I should say, the same canal where I'd once watched police pull out a suitcase containing a woman's torso. A major cleanup thereafter means the most sinister thing you're likely to find lurking today is a discarded Moccacino cup, but that's another story. Up here, the organic wine bar sapling and the wig shop, Afro World, where you can pick up a cherry red synthetic hairpiece for $25, operate next to bedding parlors and pawn shops. Meanwhile, Cypriots and Pakistanis, Bijans and Hasidic Jews coexist in that aloof way that in London passes for harmony. Canadians, too, of course, and though I don't do aloof, my otherness has never hampered my assimilation. Around these parts, otherness is assimilation. Yet I still approach the road in the manner of a tourist. When the walk to the bus stop offers a portal to another culture and era, it's hard not to. My neighbors and I like to talk about how charmingly multicultural the road is, and we claim victory when friends from Notting Hill or Camden, once far more trendy, make the pilgrimage to some refashioned Jamaican jerk shack favorably reviewed in The Guardian. What a revelation this road is, even for native Londoners. Well, that's about it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.